Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Kate Moses. She's the author of Wintering, a novel of Sylvia Plath from St. Martin's Press. It's a novel about the last months in the life of Sylvia Plath when she was working on rewriting, writing, and arranging her manuscript for Ariel. This seems to me to be one of the most difficult assumptions that an author could take on, to write the life of a woman at that degree of desperation, in that level of what she herself considered to be creative mania. What were the difficulties that you were aware of in starting this?
Well, the most immediate is the very passionate proprietariness that people feel about Sylvia Plath and their own version of who she was and what her work meant. And I knew that I would be stepping into the fray with just an amazing amount of passionate doesn't even really respond to it adequately, that the level of response to Sylvia Plath is still, 40 years after her death, something that really amazes me. And it excites me, too, because I think it's a testament to the authenticity of what she accomplished artistically. But when I set out to write this book, I was indeed intimidated by the idea that I would be putting myself right into the middle of it, especially because the story that I wanted to tell through Wintering was very much a story that I felt had not been adequately understood. And that's for many reasons, one of them being that Plath's journals from that time are either destroyed or disappeared, as Ted Hughes told us. And also because our understanding of Ariel is very much predicated on how it was published. And it was published after her death in a very different format, very different assembly than what Plath herself had intended in those last months of 1962, probably right up until her death. So the Plath that we know of, the writer of Ariel that we all think we know, is a woman who's moving furiously toward what seems like her self-destruction. And in fact, when you read the poems of Ariel in the order that Plath gave them in those last months, it's an entirely different story.
Now, the list of Plath's intended order for the poems in Ariel only came out when her collected poems did. What year was that?
I think that was 1981.
That's right. A very long time to wait to find out that information. And that, was it Hughes who had arranged the manuscript as it was published?
He did. And he actually explained that in some detail in an interview that he gave to the Paris Review a few years before his death. What he said was that he had attempted to publish Ariel as Plath had assembled it, but ran into resistance from the book editors that he sent it to, because they wondered why the final poems of the last few weeks of her life weren't included in the manuscript. Where was Edge or Balloons or the Munich Mannequins? Those weren't in the manuscript, and they weren't in the manuscript because Plath had ended her version of Ariel with poems that were written up until mid-November of 1962, but she continued to write up until days before her death. So Ted Hughes was then put in this predicament of trying to honor Plath's wishes and get her book out there and published, but at the same time, he had to wrangle with these book editors who wanted those final poems, which Plath had seen as an entirely different, an inspiration of a different order.
Now, you have decided to arrange the poems in Plath's order, and to give the chapters of your book the titles of the poems as they were meant to be arranged, the chapter titles as one goes along. And you have a very, it seems to me, almost preternatural way of knowing things, which I would imagine comes from reading the letters and the journals. For instance, you mentioned that she chooses 41 poems because there were 41 poems in Hughes' at that time most successful collection, Lupercal.
Mm-hmm.
How did you know that that was the omen for her?
I didn't really know. It was just, as many of the things in Wintering are, many of the scenes and ideas about Plath's thought process, it was just an intuition. And when I recognized that Lupercal had 41 poems, knowing anything about Plath, you tend to realize that she was highly superstitious, and she really saw her life as a series of symbols, and everything had portent for her. So I can't believe that she would have not given significance to the number of the poems and somehow attached that to Ted Hughes' success.
Again and again, I found myself astonished by details that I didn't know from the scholarship and that seemed to me to be extraordinarily intuitive. I was hoping you were going to tell me there was a letter to Aurelia, the mother, that said 41 as in Ted's book. But no, that's part of what seems to be remarkable about Wintering by my guest Kate Moses, a novel of Sylvia Plath published by St. Martin's Press, that so much of Plath seems to have gone into the decisions on points where there are still debates.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I would say that the book seems to be written within the radius of metaphors that Sylvia herself used in her poems, in her stories, in her letters, in her journals, as if you've forbidden yourself to step outside the sphere of that imagination. Is that true?
Well, I'm not sure if I forbid myself to step out of that sphere, but it was definitely the sphere that was evocative and compelling to me. And because the book, because Wintering isn't doesn't just take the poems as its inspiration, but also the whole of what we know of Sylvia Plath, her letters, her journals, her date book from 1962, even her baby book, that what I was trying to do was really create a more rounded picture of her. She was so wildly different to so many different people, and also in her writing, you can see her taking on different personas, and yet, of course, all of those were part of her, and I really wanted to try for myself, primarily, to get a picture of who this woman really was, and why would she have made the decisions that she was making artistically.
There are events that you give her in this book that may or may not have taken place. There's a spectacular ride on the horse, Ariel,
mm-hmm.
in which she goes beyond her own speeds and her own ability as a horsewoman. And it's a book that, it's an experience in the book that kind of gives you her confidence, mm-hmm. gives her the confidence to take the poems galloping this far. Another, you imagine Ted Hughes reading in front of her the aerial poems, and she can see in his eyes how overwhelmed and moved he is by them, which is a... We know that he read the poems, some mm-hmm. of them, before her death. We don't know that he read them in her presence, I believe.
Right.
And we certainly don't know that he read all of them. These seem to me to be two steps toward something that you will imagine at the end of the book that alters your Sylvia Plath. And I wondered what made you comfortable giving her really these victories.
Well, I think that Plath was looking for those victories mm-hmm. and actively seeking them out, because in so many other ways she was really shattered at this time, really shattered. And as someone who had already attempted suicide earlier in her life, I think that's a shadow that stays with you. In the case of those two scenes, which I think are really key, certainly for me, to my understanding of who she was at that time, as a scholar of Plath, I know for a fact that she never made that ride on Ariel. It just wasn't possible. I spoke to a number of people in England who were training people to ride horses at that time, and it simply wouldn't have been done to have let a woman with a very limited amount of skill alone with a horse, let alone, you know, see her off riding across really dangerous territory, because Dartmoor is not an easy place to ride. So we know for a fact that she really didn't make that ride. And yet what's amazing about Plath is that clearly through the poem Ariel, she saw herself making that ride. And she was going to ride it, as she said, through to that furious red eye of morning. And at the same time, similarly to seeing Ted Hughes read her work, I certainly don't know that a scene like that actually happened in Plath's life, but it made sense for the Plath I understand as a fictional character to have desired that moment. And it also made sense actually for the Ted Hughes that I imagined, for him to have that reaction, and not a reaction which some people might have expected of anger or betrayal, but of
astonishment
and true artistic respect. And that, I think, was so primary to the relationship between these two poets that whatever power that scene fictionally has, it's because of the truth of the real relationship between them, not as man and wife, but as poets who lived together and knew each other so intimately.
I'm speaking to Kate Moses, the author of Wintering, a novel about the last months in the life of Sylvia Plath, published by St. Martin's Press. Now, the last months have given us examples of biography as a fictional form. Listeners to Bookworm have heard Brian Hall speaking about his Lewis and Clark book, and Colin McCann speaking about his book about Nureyev. These are very different books. The Lewis and Clark is a revision of history from the depressive point of view, but also from what we now know about the imperialist venture across mm-hmm. America. The Nureyev book is a book by someone who, admiring John Berger enormously, understands that it's not just the great life, but all the lives around the great, the orbit around the central figure that provided his special context. And so in that book, we're seeing shoemakers and dressmakers and other dancers and homosexuals and bartenders. We're getting the whole sense of the retinue, the claque, and giving them their own intense validity. What did fiction give you in imagining Sylvia Plath in this book?
Well, it may seem funny to use this word in relationship to Plath, but it really gave me subtlety and an ability to make suggestions about the entirety of a character and an imagination that I really felt would have not been possible to render in nonfiction. I think that fiction allows you to wash around a subject and allow a reader to make connections that nonfiction requires of a writer in a different way. Nonfiction often requires you to make an assertion and then back it up. And certainly fiction, you can make an assertion and back it up, but you're not making it. You know, the strings of the puppet aren't going to be seen so readily with fiction, at least one can hope so. And so by, it goes back to that showing versus telling idea. I think that fiction allows you to show aspects of a story or a character that you really just can't... you can't create that same landscape with nonfiction. You have to kind of beat a reader over the head with details with nonfiction sometimes. And certainly with Sylvia Plath, who has been written about so extensively and debated so extensively, you know, how can you say something new about her that doesn't just confuse matters?
Well, that is what it seems to me in the end of the book that you do. There's almost a supernatural calm and beauty in the final chapters. She has given Hughes a kind of Grail quest, or it might be a Wizard of Oz quest. He's to go back to their house together in Dartmoor and to retrieve a jar of the honey from that she had collected from her bees, the red corduroy that she intended to use for curtains, and the apples.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's onions and potatoes
in there. The onions and potatoes I don't think were quite as important.
And he, coming home from his parents' house for Christmas, he does make the trip. And he brings the items. As in a fairy tale, he makes a mistake. He brings all six jars of honey instead of just one. In Sylvia's imagination, she is still going to go back. It's the bounty, it's the abundance, it's the joy. She is going to go back to that house and share the honey there. And so what we see is that Ariel becomes something like a season in hell, just a season in hell, and that now we're coming to a kind of reconciliation in your vision of this. She wants to start life again in this particular marriage with the hope of a healing set of symbolic gestures. Do you think this is true?
I actually do. Well, let me be more clear in my answer. I do think that what that journey really meant for Plath, and in fact, there really was a journey that Ted Hughes did go back to Court Green, their house, to collect these things for Platt that she seemed to think were absolutely essential to her. And in fact, he recorded the outcome of that journey in his own book about his relationship to Platt, The Birthday Letters. I really think that what that event meant for Platt was a kind of act of faith, not necessarily so simple as an act of faith in a marriage, but an act of faith that was very private to her. In writing Wintering, obviously one of the questions I had to ask myself was, if she had this book of poems that she knew had, as she said, will make my name, that it made her a genius of a writer, and she had gone back to London where she was being greeted in some ways with open arms by the BBC, by various magazines, you know, she was finding herself a woman on her own, given credit for being an artist on her own and not simply the wife of a greater artist. How is it that she slipped and lost all of these things, which you would think would give her a reason to live, that as well as her very small children? And that question, where did the slippage happen for her? Why wasn't this enough for her, was really the primary question for me in looking at this woman through this process of making this manuscript and trying to revive her life. And I really think that then you have to look at those final poems that she wrote in the last weeks of her life, which display what I see as a resigned lack of faith, of existential faith and faith in herself. And they're very different then from the Ariel poems, in which Platt is still hanging on to a sense of her belief in herself. And I think that moment when she asked Ted Hughes to go back for these items, and he went back for the items and, as you said, made that fairy tale mistake, at least for my fictional Platt, that would have been the blow that could not be recovered from, that there was no season after that season of Ariel, that season in hell of Ariel, that the seasons had been stolen from her inadvertently, and yet there was nothing more to look forward to.
Now, I have heard Plath people saying something very interesting, that the bell jar was like a clearing ground for the poetry, that she knew, and you have her saying it too, that it's a potboiler,
mm-hmm.
that it was written for the money, she tells her mother, and that it is to clear the space for poetry, as she says in a poem, the blood jet is poetry. Is this book a clearing ground for you in any sense?
I think definitely so. It's funny, when I started this book, it came as a result of having a really severe case of writer's block, and I had been working on another book entirely, had no intention of writing a book about Sylvia Plath. And a big part of my daily dilemma and the subject of this earlier book that I never was able to finish was, how do you as a woman balance having the very much desired life of children and family and marriage, and also have a rich private internal life and a creative life? Because actually having a creative life, especially the life of an artist, is counterintuitive to having a life with children, say, that they take up the same territory. And children really can't manage that. You have to be there or you're not. And I think back to a quote I heard Toni Morrison once say, that when she was writing Song of Solomon, she felt as though she could only experience her children as through the back of a waterfall. And I definitely think, I know that feeling. And for me, writing Wintering was in focusing on the creative process that Plath was utterly engaged in while utterly engaged in the domestic process. It allowed me a freedom to really imagine how I could do it myself. And, you know, and so, of course, this was a very strangely multi-layered experience of writing this story that I was living at the same time as my, say, five-year-old was pounding on my study door saying, "Mommy, aren't you ever coming out of there?"
Did you? Did you come out?
I did come out. I did come out. And that actually, I think, too, is part of what lends for me the poignance to this story in Wintering, that Plath didn't come out of it. And I actually do think that it was not just a flaw in her artistic imagination of herself, but beyond that, biochemical. But I do wonder if she hadn't also been shouldering the burden of the biochemical demons, whatever they were for her, if she couldn't have come out of it, because certainly the work that she was doing while balancing everything else still 40 years later has the capacity to drive people to scream at each other in public over their feelings about it.
I've been talking with Kate Moses, author of a first novel, Wintering, a novel of Sylvia Plath. Thank you, Kate, for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book of the mouse, Bob Dye.